Minnesota House Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform for the 92nd State Legislative Session will come to order. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Present.
Chair Mariani, present. Vice Chair Frazier.
Present.
Vice Chair Frazier, present. Lee Johnson.
Present.
Lee Johnson, present. Rep. Edelson.
Present.
Rep. Edelson, present. Rep. Feist.
Present.
Rep. Feist, present. Rep. Grossel.
Present.
Rep. Grossel, present. Rep. Hollins.
Present.
Rep. Hollins, present. Rep. Hewitt.
Present.
Rep. Hewitt, present. Rep. Cleavorn, excused. Rep. Long.
Present.
Rep. Long, present. Rep. Lucero.
Fantabulous Friday.
Rep. Lucero, present. Rep. Mueller.
Mueller, present.
Rep. Mueller, present. Rep. Navani.
Navani, present.
Rep. Navani, present. Rep. O'Neill.
O'Neill, present.
Rep. O'Neill, present. Rep. Pinto.
Present.
Rep. Pinto, present. Rep. Poston.
Present.
Rep. Poston, present. Rep. Raleigh.
Raleigh, present.
Rep. Raleigh, present. Rep. Vang.
Present.
Rep. Vang, present. Rep. Shung, excused. And, oh, perfect. And that concludes roll call with 18 present and one excused.
Very well, thank you. We do have a quorum. This hearing is being conducted under Minnesota House Rule 10.01, allowing for hearings to be held via use of distance learning, remote electronic voting, or voting by other means to protect the health and safety of the public, staff, and members. This hearing is being live streamed on the House website and can be accessed via this committee's page. Those wishing to offer public testimony can contact via email the committee administrator, Mr. Jamal Lundy, 24 hours prior to a hearing. And that email address is also available on the committee page. Members, we have 5 bills, although two of those should be relatively easy in terms of just time-wise for procedure. Today is Sentencing Reform Day in terms of the theme of these bills. And we're going to hear first from Representative Pinto. And so just to sort of warm up your throat a little bit, Chair Pinto, I'm wondering if you would be so kind as to move the minutes of March 10th.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Discussion, members? Lee Johnson, voice vote should suffice?
Voice vote would be fine.
Very well. Thank you, sir. All in favor of adoption of the March 10th minutes, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, and the minutes of March 10th are adopted. Representative Pinto, you've got two bills in a row, and I believe your first bill is House File 4174 with a motion to refer to Judiciary. Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, that is my motion, and I'll dive right into the bill if that's okay with you, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Members, House File 4174 is before us with a recommendation to refer to Committee on Judiciary. Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, last spring we authorized a task force to examine the intersection between the felony murder doctrine and aiding and abetting an accomplice liability doctrine. The task force has come back to us with unanimous recommendations, and the bill before you will follow through on those recommendations. I want to move right to our testifiers, but I want to make absolutely sure I don't forget to recognize Representative Kelly Moeller, who's done a huge amount of work on this bill. She's not on our committee, but this really has been a partnership with her. And I just didn't want to make sure I didn't forget that. So, but Mr. Chair, and there's a slight adjustment to the order of testifiers. I think we'll have Mr. Chair, with your permission, Ms. Granda, the vice chair, and then Ms. Cater, and then Chief Mueller, and then Ms. Donerson, which I think is just maybe a flip of the order of the second and third testifiers. But I think we're ready for Ms. Granda, with your permission, Mr. Chair.
Very well. And Chair Pinto, do you want to do the DE1 amendment now, or do you want to wait till?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That would make sense if it's all right with you. And I'll just note to committee members that this is the result of a lot of work The bill was introduced in one form, but this delete all will put the bill on a form where the committee will have a chance to full chance to consider it. So yes, Mr. Chair, I would move that.
Very well. Chair Pinto moves adoption of the DE1 amendment, puts the bill in the shape the author wishes it to be before us. Lee Johnson, can we do a voice vote on this?
That would be fine.
Very well. Thank you, sir. All in favor of adopting the DE1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, and the DE1 amendment is adopted. Chair Pinto, do you want to, I know you want to get to the testifiers. Do you want to describe the bill, or do you want to wait until after?
You know, Mr. Chair,
It is Friday, so.
It is. Well, no, Mr. Chair, I want to keep things, I know we want to keep things moving, and I actually think that over the course of the testimony that will come, become clear. I'll simply note again that we had given a charge to this task force, and they've come back with these recommendations. And the bill, as one would expect, does make reforms to our state's laws in these areas. But no, I think, Mr. Chair, we can probably dive in, and I think it'll come out as things go along.
Very well. Then the chair calls. Kilo Marie Granda, is that the right, correct order, Chair Pinto? Did I get that right? Or
That's correct, Mr. Chair, yeah, that she's the vice chair of the task force, not first.
Very well. If Ms. Granda can come forward, state your name for the record and provide us with your testimony, and we would greatly appreciate it.
Good morning, Chair and Committee. Thank you so much for allowing me this opportunity to speak. I was here actually last year and year before that, I feel like. And I was often testifying for victims' rights. And I've been asked over the past few months since Senator Gazelka appointed me to this task force, why am I so passionate about this? You know, when I've previously argued on what many people see as a different side. And I have to say it's because, and I've said this so many times, I'll continue to say it, we are all criminals. Victims can be offenders and often are, and offenders are often victims. And so for me, being able to work holistically with this task force has been an amazing experience. And together we came up with unanimous recommendations to revise relevant statutes to limit the aiding and abetting felony murder liability. Revising those relevant statutes such that those previously convicted may petition for limited relief, implementing reforms beyond mere adoption of an affirmative defense, and expanding the task force's mandate and timeline, as you know, we were on a short one, to undertake similar work and further this continued conversation and further this work. And I just want to quickly follow up with something I read yesterday. Someone that I deeply respect put this out, and I just have to say that I'm thinking of that right now. As we consider tough on crime bills, we also have to consider what would be the most appropriate qualifications for judgment, and that also holds an element of compassion as well. And that's Senator Limmer. And I just want to say that really inspired me today. So I think that's it. If you have questions for me at the end, definitely ask me. I think otherwise, Greg, our chair, is also on.
Very well. I do want to acknowledge both your work over the years and your presence in this. You have been in front of this committee a number of times, at least in front of this chair, but I suspect probably in the past as well. And so I just want to acknowledge that. And I think also it's important to acknowledge that that really reflects not a rushed attempt to make changes, but a very reasoned, deliberate, process. When I think of this task force, I think of that, the work of Representative Pinto, Mueller, Senator Chamberlain, and you and others. And so I want to acknowledge that and thank you for that. If you can stick around for questions, we would appreciate it for sure. Thank you. All right, next we have Ms. Toni Cater. If you can come forward and give your name for the record and give us your testimony, we would appreciate it.
Good morning, Chair Mariani and representatives. My name is Toni Cater, and I'm the co-founder of FMLR and the mother of Megan, an impacted person under the aiding and abetting felony murder laws. Megan and Brianna were 19 at the time of their tragedy. They both had been raped in high school and were self-medicating traumas. After Brianna's prescription medication was stolen by some friends, a young couple, Megan and Brianna wanted to get it back. A friend from high school had also had some items stolen, and the four of them, four 19 and 20-year-old kids, made the decision to go get their items back together. One thing led to another, and one of those young men decided to bring a friend, and he brought a 33-year-old uncle who brought a gun. The girls ended up having their lives threatened by this man, told if they screwed anything up, they would be killed, forced to lie on the floor of the apartment and watch their friend beaten and shot. The girls were and still are terrorized by the memories of that horrific night. Their hearts and our hearts go out to the family of the young man who lost his life that night. The girls could never have imagined what was going to happen. Megan and Brianna, the two young men who never left the car, and the two men who beat and then murdered this young man, all received the exact same charges of first-degree murder. What we now know is this is not uncommon. Megan's birthday is today, and she turns 24. Now, over 4 years into their prison sentence, Megan and Brianna continue to amaze me as they take college courses, educate themselves on trauma reduction, mentor the women around them, pray, and hold Bible studies, all while surviving the current COVID protocol, which has only allowed us a handful of visits in over 2 years. These two young women continue to have hope in the system, hope in you, and hope in their faith. I was appointed by the task force as an impact family member and chaired the outreach subcommittee. On two occasions, the task force had opportunity to listen to men and women within the DOC who currently are serving sentences under these laws. This day was very impactful for all. What has stood out most to me on this task force were the disparities in sentencing, disparities by county, by age, and most glaringly, race. 64% of those convicted are persons of color. I believe this reform will promote public safety and justice at the same time. It will allow those wrongly convicted of the crimes of another to come home to their families, to be active in our communities, good neighbors, taxpaying, working individuals. Minnesota is not safer with Megan and Brianna in prison, nor is Minnesota safer with Rosalyn or Chris or others locked up for extensively long sentences for crimes they did not commit. I am here today as an impacted mother and the co-founder of FMLR, and I'm asking you for your support in moving this bill forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cater, and thank you for your humanistic vision and energy and passion that you bring to this critically important issue. Please convey my well wishes and appreciation to Brianna for continuing to better herself, to be a strong person for herself and for others around her. And please extend that to the others as well on my behalf. If you can stick around also for questions, we greatly appreciate it. Thank you, Ms. Cater. With that, next we'll move to Chief Brian Mueller of Stillwater. Chief, if you can come forward. State your name for the record and give us your testimony. We would appreciate that.
Yes. Can you hear me, Mr. Chair?
Yes, indeed.
Perfect. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Brian Mueller. I'm the Stillwater Chief of Police and member of the Task Force for Aiding and Abetting Felony Murder. I've been appointed jointly by the Minnesota Chiefs Police Association and the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. I'm also former chair of the Violent Crime Coordinating Council, which is where I've come before you in the past. What I want to stress today more than anything else is that the proposed reform to limit liability for aiding and abetting felony murder will not negatively affect public safety. It will, in fact, enhance public safety. Looking at the issues through a law enforcement lens, I have to admit, early on, I was skeptical at first. As a police chief, I know that homicides are some of the most serious offenses we see, which have rippling effects to our community. There's no duty we hold more sacred than the duty to protect our communities we serve from loss of life. During my time on this task force, I've heard stories much like Ms. Cater just described. Study the data, engage in open, productive discussion with other task force members. I realize that an inconsequential actor's involvement in a death does not impact public safety in the same way that those immediately related to that homicide does. In law enforcement, we protect the public by concentrating our efforts on the most factually culpable actors while seeing to it that others who may have lesser involvement are still processed accordingly. That is exactly what this bill will allow us to do. When our task force submitted its final report, I was proud to add my law enforcement voice to the unanimous agreement of the principles this bill aims to advance. Proportionate punishment does promote public safety. The reform the task force recommended, which is incorporated into this bill, will make our streets safer. Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for the time to testify.
Chief, thank you for your testimony, for your time today. Thank you for your work on this task force. No doubt involved quite a many hours and efforts while you were also continuing to fill your duty in helping to advance public safety in Stillwater, Minnesota. So we greatly appreciate your time, your effort, and your voice here today. If you could also stick around, hopefully, for questions, I would certainly appreciate that. Thank you, Chief. Next we have, and I hope I pronounce this correctly. If I don't, please absolutely correct me. Jamisha Donerson, if you can come forward and give your name for the record, give us your testimony, we'd appreciate it.
Hi, I'm Jamisha Donerson.
Jamisha, all right. Welcome.
At the age of 16, a situation occurred at home which made me feel unsafe for me to live there. I left home and turned to the street for comfort. And during that time, I met a 24-year-old male who robbed and murdered someone while I was waiting in the car. From there, my 16-year-old life has changed. I was charged and convicted of murder. When I never saw my victim face, I never knew the victim. I went to being charged as an adult. But I never had the chance of becoming an adult or knowing what an adult is. Even the jails or prisons, they didn't even know what to do with me. They kept me on 23 hours lockdown because they still considered me, although I was charged as an adult, they still considered me a minor who couldn't be around adults. So I was locked down 23 hours a day. I was sentenced to 12 years for this murder that I did not commit. I served 8, and during my sentence, I did all the programming that I could possibly do. I got my GED. I paid for the paralegal program that was offered. And I tried to do all the right things to make myself, you know, be productive when I enter back into society. Upon my release, I was told that the paralegal program wasn't accredited, which was a blow. Then I experienced, you can't get this job. You can't get that job, this apartment due to my background. Every day is a fight to prove yourself constantly, to have to explain to others. I'm labeled a murderer, but I never really murdered anyone. Or trying to explain to others what second-degree murder means unintentionally. Excuse me. Okay. What second-degree murder means unintentionally.
You're doing fine, Jamisha. Take your time.
And hoping that someone will give you a chance at a job or apartment and see that, you know, you're not what you are, what they say you are on paper, or take the time out to read the story of what they say you are. I just want to thank Tony for giving me this opportunity to speak and share this story, because we're all are affected, not just the victim, everyone. And I want to thank Kevin Reese to the Until We All Free movement to constantly give me hope every day to keep going and keep striving. Don't give up. Someone will listen. And I just hope that this passed, because it's hard to be labeled a murder and knowing that you never murdered anyone, you know? Thank you.
Thank you, Jamisha. Please know this chair sees you. I hear you. I see your dignity. I see your worth. And I want you to keep a hold of hope and keep going forward. And I really want you to know how much I appreciate, and this committee appreciates, the courage that you're exhibiting by being with us here today to share your story and offer your hopes for your legislature to be able to act in a better way. So continued best wishes to you, and stay in contact with us and let us know how things are going.
Thank you so much.
Very well. Thank you. All right, Chair Pinto, that's all I have for testifiers. If it's okay, I'd like to move forward with committee discussion.
Yes, Mr. Chair, the one thing is I probably should have taken you up on the offer at the beginning to provide a better orientation to
please
the bill.
I'll
do that real briefly. I suspect, for purposes of O'Neill may have something she wants to say in response to the testifiers, but I'll quickly do this and then, and just so members that really it's quite simple. Section one of the bill, takes our aiding and abetting and accomplice liability that is standard across different crimes and says that for this narrow set of circumstances that involve felony murder, and to remind members, that's a circumstance where someone dies, there's a felony that's committed, there's no intention for that person to die, but it happens that there's a felony that's committed at the same time. We have that doctrine that a person can be convicted of that. But for that circumstance, that aiding and abetting felony murder, we're going to limit those circumstances to say that somebody can only be charged with aiding and abetting felony murder if they, in fact, have responsibility and culpability relating to what happened in the circumstance described in Section 1. We want to make sure that's true going forward, that's Section 1. We also want to make sure that people who were convicted previously under those circumstances that we now have decided are unjust and should change, there's a way for them that for there to be retroactive application, and that's Section 2, and it sets up a process for the people, for someone who had a previous conviction to be able to have that changed, possibly resentenced. And then Section 3, as the Vice Chair Ms. Granda referenced, Sections 3 and 4, continue the task force to continue to explore these issues. I know we can get into more detail, but that's the basic orientation to the bill. And then, yes, Mr. Chair, certainly ready for questions.
Very well. So let's proceed in that matter. First, we have Representative O'Neill, followed by Representative Frazier. Representative O'Neill.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Pinto. While the testimony was compelling, I'm actually not going to talk about that. Representative Pinto, I'm going to surprise you today. So Section 2 is of concern to me. So if we're talking about resentencing and retroactivity, so I was really racking my brain, and maybe you can think of it, but I couldn't think of a time when we've done that statutorily, where we've gone back and done retroactivity. Typically, we don't do that. And I'm wondering if you can help me remember some example in the legislature where we have done that.
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative O'Neill, great point. And I will say that this is a section that there's been a lot of thought that's gone into and a lot of work that's gone into, because it certainly is not something that is done regularly. I'll certainly give you that. I will say that a couple things. So one is that this section is probably properly more in the jurisdiction of the Judiciary Committee. So assuming the bill moves forward, that's probably more the place that we should really examine that, because it does have to do more with the court process as opposed to Section 1 being more in our jurisdiction. Having said that, though, it is a narrow set of circumstances, and I will point out to you that it is time limited. But the thought is that if someone has had this prior conviction under circumstances where they there was so little connection between them and the death that occurred, such that we're saying that if they were charged now that they wouldn't be convicted, then there should be an opportunity for them to make that change. So you're right that it's not a real common thing, though I don't know that it's completely unprecedented at all. And it seems pretty unjust to not allow for that mechanism if we can make it work. I'll say there's been a lot of effort that's gone into setting up this process, and I really think that it does work quite well.
Representative Olio.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Pinto. Yeah, I couldn't think of any situation myself that we've done that. The only thing that even comes close maybe is in 2013, we passed a provision so that people who had been victims of childhood sexual abuse perpetrated by churches and other nonprofit organizations and so on could go back, and we lifted the statute of limitations for that three-year window. But this is quite different than that. Obviously, this is a criminal act that, so instead of the victim having an opportunity, this is actually criminal or perpetrator, however you want to characterize it, is given an opportunity for retroactivity and resentencing. And I couldn't think of any instance where we have done that. And that's why I honestly was asking if you had researched that, Representative Pinto had any thoughts or could help, you know, add that to the conversation. I recognize that we're in public safety and not judiciary. I've served on public safety and judiciary for a long time, not currently, but usually I've served in both of those. So that's one of my concerns. The last section 3, I believe it is, about moving forward and continuing this work. This is really complicated stuff. This is very emotional stuff. So I wholeheartedly would like to see this continue and have the conversation move. But I take great pause when we're talking about kind of, I won't say unprecedented, but I couldn't think of precedents before this. And I guess you couldn't really either come up with something specific where we're looking retroactively to do this resentencing. So I understand the why, believe me. The two mothers that have started this have been in my office many, many times. Former Representative Mary Liz Holberg has been a part of this effort, who has been trying very hard to come up with some solutions. I get the why. My concern is precedence, and, you know, that's my concern. If you can give me something where we've done this before, that would be very helpful for me and my deliberation today.
Sure, Pinto.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative O'Neill, as we're sitting here right now, to be honest, Representative Moeller has really focused a lot more in this section two. So I'm doing some section number two, I should say. And so I'm doing some looking to reach out. I'm pretty sure that there are other examples. I'm just looking for that. I will note, though, if we understand the why, to my mind, the fact that there, even if there hadn't been something before, and I really think there has been, but boy, if we know the why, the thought that someone is spending more time in prison merely because we haven't previously acted in the just and fair way to make sure to acknowledge that there shouldn't have been liability in the first place, why would we possibly have them continue to be in prison then, just because there hadn't been a prior example of doing this? I believe that there is. But boy, that strikes me as not being a good way for us to be handling things, to leave somebody in prison simply because there hasn't been a prior mechanism to do this. So if it's not fair, it should matter whether it's in the past or not. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative O'Neill, you're good for now?
Just one final thing.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't want to take up a ton of time. It's just something that I had long conversations with this group before they came here today. The only other suggestion I would make, and I realize, again, this is probably in judiciary, but if there's some sort of a panel that reviews the applications, if this is the direction that you want to move and you see this as an important measure of justice, that the other concern is that there is an application of the law possibly different between counties or even judicial districts. And so here's just a suggestion from a member who's been here a while, is if you had a panel that was the statewide panel, and I've used this from other working groups I've been on, to kind of funnel through and look at all the applications. And then potentially, if you do the resentencing in a district, whether it be county or even a different judicial district, different than they were sentenced the first time, you might get a better outcome. Just a thought.
Mr. Chair, real briefly.
Chair Pinto.
Yeah, real briefly. So Representative O'Neill, great minds think alike, because the bill actually does is set up that way. So all the petitions go through Ramsey County District Court. So there is one uniform place, no matter where it happened around the state, to at least do that look. And I should say that I did phone a friend as you were texting, and the point was made to me that our post-conviction statutes already take into account new case law and retroactivity being a case law concept. So the reason that it's rare to be put in statute is that usually it can be done via post-conviction relief. And so we sort of don't need to have it in this form. It's just because of the timing. It's a different way. And I also know that other states have done this as well. So really, we would not be treading new ground in that way. So hopefully that's reassuring to you. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Representative O'Neill. An excellent line of questioning and recommendation and problem solving, frankly, which is what our committee time should be about. Representative Frazier, followed by Representative Novotny. Vice Chair Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Pinto, for bringing this bill. I just want to make a couple of comments. Again, thank you to the testifiers, to the mom, Ms. Cater. You know, this kind of blows me away, the work that's been done here. You know, it started from, you know, the harm that you've had and with your kids, and you got this going as an advocate, a task force, to now we've got this this unanimous decision here from the task force that's got this bill before us. And I got to say, to Representative O'Neill, I understand what you were saying, but I got to say, you know, if we want to set precedent, we should set this type of precedence. We know that we have a system that is unjust. Ms. Cater shared the numbers, the disproportionality of who this impacts. So we know we have an unjust system. Anytime we can put policies in place that can right some wrongs, that can cure some past wrongs of a system that we have in place, that is the type of precedence we should be looking to set every single time we have the ability to do that. So I got to tell you, the retroactivity piece is one of the most important pieces to me, because it can go back and it can fix those wrongs that we've had historically. And Representative Pinto, I want to thank you and Moeller, because I know as prosecutors, that's not an easy thing to continue to carry. But I want to thank you for doing the right thing. And I'm absolutely supporting this bill. Thank you for bringing it.
Thank you, Chair Vice Chair Frazier. Representative Ivey.
Thank you, Chair Mariani, for Representative Pinto. There's a lot of words that substantially raise the threshold for proof in the language here. You know, intentionally acts with extreme indifference, short of a post-Miranda conviction. Can you think of any way that you would be able to prove someone's intent in these cases? And are there any cases that you've prosecuted where you've been able to show someone's intent without a Miranda admissible statement?
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Representative Devani. I have to say, actually, I mean, I feel like we have to prove intent all the time in all kinds of cases, and plenty of cases where there's not a confession. And so I don't think, I mean, so maybe just to kind of drill down a little bit, I'm on page one of the bill, or the delete all, and, you know, the word, you know, cannot be held criminally liable unless the person intentionally aided, advised, hired, counseled. That word intentionally there is in the current language for accomplice liability. That is current law, standard law, no change there at all. It's that next line that the person did that with the intent to cause the death of a human being. And I'll note that that is murder one, right? That is the most serious form of murder. And so we expect that there would be intent in the person who is the primary actor. Remember that we're talking about someone who has not themselves caused the death. This is someone who is in the aiding and abetting situation. And so in that situation, yeah, I would feel that there certainly are circumstances where that is not going to be, where there's no need to have a confession. And the second area, which is murder two in paragraph B there, 1.9 to 1.11, the references to major participant and acting with extreme indifference to human life, that comes from a language that was pulled from another state. I'm trying to pull up what's called the jury instructions, the JIGs, for that, because we do have that. But I'll just say that extreme indifference to human life, what that references in the case law in that state is acting with even recklessness or negligence. Because I should point out, it says extreme indifference, and the word extreme is in there. We're really talking about someone who is not taking any sort of precautions, acting in a way where the other person could be put in great danger. And again, the person has to be a major participant in the underlying felony, because let's remind ourselves, we're talking about felony murder, where there is a felony that's committed, a death that occurs that's not necessarily connected directly to the felony, no intention by the person who did it. And now we're talking about someone who is aiding or abetting that situation, who is yet another step removed. So I know, very long answer to your question, but I'll just say that, yeah, I do not think that a confession would be necessary to prove in these circumstances if the person we're trying to charge is actually involved in the situation and not in a car on the street outside.
And going back to go ahead,
Representative Ivey.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Representative Pinto, going back to my original question, can you think of a case where you've ever been able to prove what is on someone's mind or what was their intent in a conspiracy case like this without that convention.
Chair Pinto.
Mr. Chair, well, actually, Representative Nadi, it's funny that you used that word conspiracy just before the end, because actually where I flash back to is the cases in our state that have the longest sentences for sex trafficking. I was a prosecutor with a colleague of mine in Ramsey County. Those are conspiracy cases. I had no statements by the defendants at all, ever. In fact, I'm not just the police. I don't think I had an email or anything. What I had was tons of evidence showing their intention through emails, through the fact that they were driving these women, various things. That's a sex trafficking situation, of course. But absolutely, we proved conspiracy in that case, which required proving intent with not a single statement from the defendants to anybody. And got 36 and 40-year sentences for sex trafficking. So absolutely, you can prove intent without having statements from the defendant, and we do it all the time.
Representative Mani.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. I think we're making some substantial changes to longstanding, commonly held beliefs that are pretty much nationwide in aiding and abetting laws. And although I think there is room for some modifications and changing of thresholds, I'll be voting against it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Vandy. Lee Johnson, and then we'll move for a vote. Lee Johnson.
Chair Mariani, Representative Pinto, and to the testifiers, thank you for the work you've done on this. I do also have concerns on this bill. There's many to choose from. One thing I have is on line point 1.10, where it talks about major participant. I'm just wondering what if Representative Pinto can explain what the definition of major participant is. I've searched our entire Minnesota statutes, and those words are not in it. There's no definition, no nothing.
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm gonna turn to the task force's chair, if I may, Greg Egan, who's an attorney, someone I've worked with, to respond to this, if I may, Mr. Chair.
And Chair Pinto, who is that you're referring to?
I'm sorry, I'm Greg Egan. He is on the line with us right now.
Very well. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Egan. State your name for the record. I believe you heard the inquiry.
I have. It's Gregory Egan, E-G-A-N. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your question, Representative. This was left deliberately open. What we want to do is to give discretion on a case-by-case basis to deal with these individualized facts of the various prosecutions. One of the things that was very important to us is that we did not restrict prosecution discretion in these types of cases. So what we have here is a mechanism for this to be developed through case law. There is a guide for that. We modeled the statute in part on the California statute passed a couple of years ago. So there already is persuasive authority in the case law for the refinement or definitions, if you will, of both of those concepts, the major participant and, of course, the extreme indifference to human life. So what we have is a mechanism that maintains prosecution discretion and that also maintains the ability to still prosecute if it is in the interest of justice, even in the cases that we're describing. And it's not just unwriting, aiding and abetting law, accomplice liability, and it's not rewriting felony murder liability. It's just a narrow intersection of those two doctrines where we're two steps removed, where it's not somebody who intended the death and also not someone who actually committed the act. So I want to stress that it's a fairly narrow set of circumstances, and I want to stress that even within those circumstances, there's still a viable mechanism to prosecute in appropriate cases on a case-by-case basis as the judicial system is intended to operate. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Egan, for your very thorough explanation. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani. Members, that even made me more concerned, because we have to set out very carefully what the circumstances are. We need definitions for the judges and the lawyers in the charging aspect of it to know exactly what it is. This is so wide open, it's never been used before We have no idea where it's going to go. That's what we are here to do, is to make sure we have the parameters set. This is leaving the parameters wide open. And that's not good, and that's not how we do proper legislation. I also have a question. One thing that's in there is about the retroactive application. I'm just wondering, see, this bill goes into effect August 1st if it's passed, and it only leaves 2 months for the commissioner to go through and notify everybody that it may affect. I'm just wondering, since it's such a short time period, how many possible, Representative Pinto would know, how many possible cases and this could affect, you know, that are currently in our either prison or our probation system? Mr.
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, Representative Johnson, my understanding is that it's under 100. It would be expected. I'll sort of see if I think that's correct. Maybe the chair and vice chair kind of nod. It's sort of the expectation here. Yeah, that's about would be the number of folks expected. That kind of a range.
Lee Johnson.
Representative Pinto, thank you. I'm just wondering if there's been with 100 cases, that's going to the Ramsey County and then going back to the original cases of jurisdiction. I'm just wondering if a fiscal note has been required, so you have an idea how much this is, how much is it going to affect the judicial system's budget?
Chair Pinto, fiscal note.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I think fiscal note has been requested, and we'll get a sense of that, Representative Johnson, as things move forward. We'll get a sense of that.
And so this move into the judiciary, hopefully provide that committee with judiciary accounts to be able to review that. Lee Johnson?
Chair Mariani, members. Like I said, I'm going to end it there. We got a long day. I'd like to get done early if we can possibly today.
Sounds good.
I just have trouble right now. I just have trouble with this. I understand the circumstances, why it's coming forward, but I think it's even if the DE amendment, this bill needs quite a bit more work, and I cannot support it at this time.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. All right, Representative Pinto, why don't you close us out, and then we'll take a vote on the motion.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for the really productive discussion. So just a few points. There is a national trend, a strong trend in this direction. I should say, I believe the U.S. is the only country, one of the few countries with the English common law system that even retains the felony murder doctrine to begin with. But then there's a strong trend in states to move in this direction. There's also a strong background, not only of the retroactivity that we've discussed, but I guess I want to reassure Representative Johnson and the other states that have this, there are clear steps to ask regarding if someone's a major participant. I'm looking at the jury instructions from other states, asking what was the defendant's role in planning the crime, role in supplying weapons, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot of background, a lot of infrastructure in place regarding those terms that you've expressed concerns about. And strong precedent for that. That's discussed in the task force report, which is posted. I really urge members to take a look at that and that national trend discussed on page 25 of the task force. Members, when I brought this bill to you last spring for the task force, I said that I had concerns and doubts myself. My thought was, this is a question of where this intersection of doctrines, I wasn't sure where things would go. A group of victims' rights advocates, families, prosecutors, police officers, and others got together, worked extremely hard, and came back with unanimous recommendations that said we should move in this direction. A group worked together hard to put together this bill, which allows people who did not have a connection, a direct connection with the death, to have that recognized. And that is only just and only fair. I would defy anyone to look at this and say, well, we want to make sure that someone has a conviction when they were not, in fact, a major participant, and et cetera, et cetera. Members, the infrastructure's in place. We've been told unanimously that we need to move forward on this. And I really urge that you do that. Mr. Chair, finally, I'm so grateful to the task force, Mr. Egan, Ms. Granda, to the families, Ms. Donerson, for their work and for leading us in this. And really, members, I'd urge you to stand with them and provide a yes vote. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. It sounds like part of your own journey kind of mirrors, Chief Mueller's journey. He rightly entered into this, with a public safety concern. That's his duty and no doubt his personal commitment. As a result of a very good process, I think, arrived at a conclusion, similar to yours and others, that there's a justice that can be done here. And in his case, that doesn't compromise public safety. In your case, it doesn't compromise the integrity of our judiciary system. And so, kudos to all of you for very tough work and the open mind in which you went into it. Special kudos to Ms. Cater, Ms. Granda for being, passionate drivers of this. And of course, to people like Jamesia and others who have been caught up in this. And thank you, Mr. Egan, for being with us here today, for your work on the task force as well. With that, Representative Pinto renews his motion that House File 4174, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Judiciary, and the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Aye.
Chair Mariani, aye. Vice Chair Frazier. Vice Chair Frazier?
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier, aye. Lee Johnson?
No.
Lee Johnson, nay. Rep. Edelson?
Aye.
Rep. Edelson, aye. Rep. Feist?
Aye.
Rep. Feist, aye. Rep. Grossel?
No.
Rep. Grossel, nay. Rep. Hollins?
Aye.
Rep. Hollins, aye. Rep. Hewitt?
Aye.
Rep. Hewitt, aye. Rep. Cleavorn?
Cleavorn, aye.
Rep. Cleavorn, aye. Rep. Long?
Aye.
Rep. Long, aye. Rep. Lucero? Rep. Lucero? Rep. Lucero, absent. Rep. Mueller?
Mueller votes yes.
Rep. Mueller, aye. Rep. Novotny?
Novotny, no.
Rep. Novotny, nay. Rep. O'Neill?
Move the conversation forward. I vote yes.
Rep. O'Neill, aye. Rep. Pinto?
Aye.
Rep. Pinto, aye. Rep. Poston?
Aye.
Rep. Poston, aye. Rep. Raleigh?
Raleigh, aye.
Rep. Raleigh, aye. Rep. Vang?
Aye.
Rep. Vang, aye. Rep. Shung?
No, aye.
Rep. Shung, aye. With 15 ayes, 3 nays, and 1 absent, that concludes roll call.
Very well. With 15 ayes, 3 nays, and 1 absent, the motion prevails, and House File 4174, as amended, is referred to the Committee on Judiciary. Thank you, Chair Pinto, and again, thank you to your testifiers. Chair Pinto, you have House File 3013, and I believe your motion is to refer this to the General Register.
That is correct. That is my motion, Mr. Chair.
Very well. House File 3013 is before us with a referral, with a vote to refer to the General Register. Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to try this process again, that the real expert on this is my testifier from our Sentencing Guidelines Commission. And what I'm inclined to do is have him describe the bill and for efficiency, Mr. Chair, and we can see if there's pieces I need to add, but we'll defer to him.
Very well. And let me make sure. I think you have an amendment.
You know, Mr. Chair, I do. That is a good point. It's just a technical amendment that I would offer that just does a bit of cleanup on the bill to this will make it match how the bill is moving in the other body. Just a few technical corrections there, Mr. Chair.
All right, so really shapes this up in the way you wish it. With some technical changes. Chair Johnson, we're okay with a voice vote on this?
Yes, we are.
Very well. Thank you, sir. All in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. And the A1 amendment is adopted. And Chair Pinto, it seems like this is a good time to call Mr. Wright's great Wright's.
Yes, please.
Wright's last name. Holy cow. Oh, boy. Nate, if you can come forward and give us your name for the record and give us your testimony, we'd appreciate it. Good to see you again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Nate Wrights. I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. Thank you for this opportunity to testify in support of House File 3013, the bill to give the five state employees whom I supervise the employment protections that come with classified status. When I accepted this job 7.5 years ago, I was well aware of the excellent customer service reputation that the MSGC staff had earned. When you called, a friendly, well-informed human answered the phone with accurate and helpful guidance. When you asked for particular sentencing data, you got a tailor-made data report quickly, accurately, and professionally. I knew before I started that my primary goal must be, and still is, not to mess up that excellent reputation. The five analysts on the MSGC staff model the best of what it means to be a state employee, and it is on behalf of these outstanding public servants that I testify today. In the last biennium, as I was researching options to meet what then appeared to be a looming agency budget crunch, I was surprised to learn that because MSGC staff members are statutorily unclassified employees, they are not eligible for layoff. In the event of a budget shortfall, their appointments would simply be terminated with no assurances of reappointment once funding resumed. In addition, unclassified employees are ineligible for protections against at-will termination, so they are essentially always in a probationary status. This bill updates a statutory provision that goes way back 44 years when the Minnesota legislature created the nation's first sentencing guidelines commission. When it did so, the 1978 legislature made the entire staff unclassified for reasons that are not obvious today. These five analysts do not fit the ordinary mold of unclassified employees. They are not elected. They are not agency heads or deputies. They deal in public data and policies, not confidential commission deliberations. They are not required to be loyal to a particular commission, but serve impartially under a new commission as often as every 4 years. And they do not report directly to the commission as I do. Finally, they are certainly not temporary employees. Among the five of them, the average length of state service is 20 years. This bill simply corrects this outdated provision of the law by making these five analysts regular classified state employees, giving them the same protections against termination and eligibility for layoff that nearly all other MAPE contract employees enjoy. This no expense, common sense, entirely non-controversial bill is supported by me, by the five employees themselves, and by the unanimous Sentencing Guidelines Commission, which wrote in last year's report to the legislature, because MSGC staff require a great deal of specialized technical expertise where continuity is vital, these five positions are long overdue for the employment protections that come with classified service. I should also add this bill has received no votes in two committees in the other body. In short, this bill is the right thing to do by these fine state employees. Mr. Chair, on behalf of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission, I thank Representative Pinto for authoring this good bill. I thank you for hearing it, and I respectfully ask for the committee's support.
Thank you, Director Wrights, and thank you for running a first-class shop over at the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. Let's open up for any questions. Chair Pinto, I'm not seeing any questions, and so I'll let you close this out, and then we'll take a vote.
Well, I'll just thank Mr. Wrights and his whole that whole office for their hard work. I think we can all agree that that the staff of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission worked enormously hard, and this seems like absolutely something that we should be doing on behalf of the analysts who work in that office. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. Chair Pinto renews his motion that House File 3013 as amended be referred to the General Register. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Aye.
Chair Mariani, aye. Vice Chair Frazier.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier, aye. Lee Johnson.
Aye.
Lee Johnson, aye. Rep. Edelson.
Aye.
Rep. Edelson, aye. Rep. Feist.
Aye.
Rep. Feist, aye. Rep. Grossel.
Aye.
Rep. Grossel, aye. Rep. Hollins.
Aye.
Rep. Hollins, aye. Rep. Hewitt.
Aye.
Rep. Hewitt, aye. Rep. Cleavorn.
Cleavorn, aye.
Rep. Cleavorn, aye. Rep. Long?
Aye.
Rep. Long, aye. Rep. Lucero? Rep. Lucero? Rep. Mueller?
Mueller votes yes.
Rep. Mueller, aye. Rep. Novotny?
Novotny, aye.
Rep. Novotny, aye. Rep. O'Neill?
O'Neill, aye.
Rep. O'Neill, aye. Rep. Pinto?
Aye.
Rep. Pinto, aye. Rep. Poston?
Aye.
Rep. Poston, aye. Rep. Raleigh?
Raleigh, aye.
Rep. Raleigh, aye. Rep. Vang?
Aye.
Rep. Vang, aye. Rep. Shung?
Shung, aye.
Rep. Shung, aye. Last call for Rep. Lucero? Rep. Lucero absent. And that concludes roll call with 18 ayes and one absent.
Very well. With 18 ayes, no nays, and one absent, House File 3013 as amended. Motion prevails and House File 3013 as amended is referred to the General Register. Thank you again, Chair Pinto. Thank you, Mr. Rice. Please, and please extend our appreciation to the fine public servants at the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will.
Thank you. With that, members, the chair will turn to House File 1152, Representative Long. Chair Long, we heard this bill last week, I believe. We laid it over. And so the chair is bringing this bill up for a motion because we've discovered that judiciary is going to need to look at this bill. And so I don't really feel we need to debate it any further. We would have made this motion and voted on it at the time that we weren't aware of the need to do so. Chair Long, if you just tell us quickly what the bill is and, confirm my explanation, and we can open up, see if there's any questions, and move to a vote.
Happy to, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So this will be the bill as amended. We adopted the DE2 in the last our last meeting. And just a reminder that makes some significant changes from the original draft, including removing all felonies from eligibility for automatic expungement. So this only includes misdemeanors. And those are only targeted misdemeanors, so no person crimes, no criminal sexual conduct, or enhanceable offenses. It also still maintains the ability for DHS and other sensitive employment roles to have access for background check purposes, still maintains the ability for courts, for prosecutors, and law enforcement to access records. And we had some discussion last week as well about protections for employers, did some research in the interim, and do want to confirm that this, paired with current law under 181-981, would extend significant protections to employers if they're sued after hiring someone based on an expunged record. I'll just remind the committee, this bill has broad support, including the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, multiple business organizations, Justice Action Network, and the Minnesota Catholic Conference. We did not have opposition testimony in our hearing last week. And since we met, we've also received a letter of support from Violence Free Minnesota and MnCASA. And I'll just want to read the closing sentence where they said that the Clean Slate Act is, quote, an important step in eliminating barriers and collateral consequences of a criminal record and will help to increase safety and stability for survivors and their families in Minnesota. So in sum, Mr. Chair, this bill, I think, provides a really important opportunity for redemption, for rehabilitation, and for a second chance. And I would ask members to vote to support to move to judiciary.
Very well. Thank you, Chair Law. Thank you for the follow-up to some of the questions, particularly the current perspectives of survivor groups, victim survivor groups to this. Members, quick questions? Rep. Samuel.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Long. I got to talk to Representative Long about this yesterday and asked if he had talked to any of the law enforcement at all about this, just to see how their reaction was to it, and talked to my sheriff yesterday and gave him all of this. And at this time, he didn't see any opposition to it as either. And so I'm excited to be able to see this move along to judiciary. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Mueller. Representative O'Neill.
I don't have a question, but I just wanted to say that, I worked at Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge, And one thing that's incredibly important for restoration, for healing, for moving forward to being a productive citizen is to have those avenues open. And I really do appreciate the fact that there are not felonies in to be considered, that there are not violent crimes to be considered, but it gives someone an opportunity to restore their life. And of course, you know, I've done a lot of work in my 10 years here in that sort of vein of helping people to find restoration and healing. And obviously we want people that are committing criminal acts to choose a different path. And in my view, anyway, I believe that this is that opportunity to move people forward, to help them to make life changes and make that a little bit easier in all of the collateral consequences that come. And obviously we want to hold people accountable, but also move them forward in their life so that it's easier to choose the path of productivity and less easy to choose the path of criminality. So that's where I land on this, and I'll be a yes today.
Very wise words, Representative O'Neill. Thank you for those thoughts. All right. With that, then, Chair Long Renews.
Mr. Chair, this is Rep. Grousel. I have no way to raise my hand, so I apologize.
No, you don't need to apologize at all. Rep. Grousel, please.
I did have one question from last week, and it is in reference to, I know Representative Long said that felonies are taken out, and I'm glad for that. But how about felonies, how about the stays for certain felonies, like stays of adjudication and so on? Will those people be eligible?
Chair Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, so we have, if gross misdemeanor is tried as a felony, then that is excluded. In terms of stays, I would defer to Brian, to House research staff, if maybe they could be specific in that regard.
All right, let's see if Mr. Johnson is feeling better today.
Mr. Chair and members, it's not much better today, maybe a tiny bit.
You sound a little bit better, Ben.
Representative Gross, my understanding is that the question is related to stays of adjudication and other grants. Is my understanding of your question correct?
Representative Gross.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, Mr. Johnson, if they get a stay of adjudication for a crime that would otherwise be a crime sex felony or something similar, or a stay of imposition or something like that, would these people still be eligible for this this legislation?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grossel, to take the second part first, a stay of imposition, the answer is very clearly no. They would not be eligible. That would also apply if a felony conviction was in place, but it was sentenced as a gross misdemeanor or a misdemeanor offense, which is always a possibility. Those would also not qualify. However, there is a provision making stays of adjudication eligible. That is subdivision 2 of the first section.
Representative Grossel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Long, these people who have received state adjudication for something that they're standing up in court and admitting to what they've done to receive this plea, the state of adjudication, I can see your reasoning to try to help people move forward, but these individuals, possibly because of victim not being able to testify or child not being able to testify to what happened to them, therefore leaving the county attorneys with no other recourse except for to give them a stay of adjudication or to plead to this stay of adjudication. I cannot support that. They have admitted to this. So please, I mean, if you can fix that for down the road here.
Very well. Representative Long, anything quickly on this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Grousel, I'd certainly be happy to discuss that with you. And we have another stop in judiciary where you and I both serve. So be happy to follow up on that.
All right. Very well. All right.
Thank you, Representative Long. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Of course. Thank you, Representative Grousel. With that, members, Chair Long, Representative Long renews his motion at House File 1-1. 5-2 as amended be referred to the Committee on Judiciary. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani?
Aye.
Chair Mariani, aye. Vice Chair Frazier?
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier, aye. Lee Johnson?
Aye.
Lee Johnson, aye. Rep. Edelson?
Aye.
Rep. Edelson, aye. Rep. Feist?
Aye.
Rep. Feist, aye. Rep. Grossel?
At this time, no, sir.
Rep. Grossel, nay. Rep. Hollins?
Aye.
Rep. Hollins, aye. Rep. Hewitt?
Aye.
Rep. Hewitt, aye. Rep. Cleavorne?
Cleavorne, aye.
Rep. Cleavorne, aye. Rep. Long?
Aye.
Rep. Long, aye. Rep. Lucero? Rep. Lucero? Rep. Mueller?
Mueller votes yes.
Rep. Mueller, aye. Rep. Novotny?
Novotny, aye.
Rep. Novotny, aye. Rep. O'Neill?
O'Neill, aye.
Rep. O'Neill, aye. Rep. Pinto?
Aye.
Rep. Pinto, aye. Rep. Poston?
Aye.
Rep. Poston, aye. Rep. Raleigh?
Raleigh, aye.
Rep. Raleigh, aye. Rep. Vang?
Aye.
Rep. Vang, aye. Rep. Shung?
No, aye.
Rep. Shung, aye. Last call for Rep. Lucero? Rep. Lucero, absent. With 17 ayes, one nay, and one absent, that concludes roll call.
Very well. With 17 ayes, one nay, and one absent, House File, the motion prevails, and House File 1152, as amended, is referred to the Committee on Judiciary. Thank you, Chair Long. Best wishes on this in Judiciary, a very important bill. With that, members, we're going to turn our attention to our two final bills. This next one should go relatively quickly. The chair moves House File 3869 be referred to the General Register. That is my bill, and quite frankly, it's a bill that allows me to have some flexibility on the floor of the House. We commonly refer to these as vehicle bills, so there's no substantive major changes, but there are changes. They're clearly, supported by the need for good lawmaking. So this bill simply clarifies in statute to make certain conditions, to make conditions for enhancing a kidnapping reference clear in the way that it's written in state statute. And so that's basically it, and I would seek your support. Any questions? Seeing none, the chair renews his motion that 3869 be referred to the General Registry, and the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Aye.
Chair Mariani, aye. Vice Chair Frazier.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier, aye. Lee Johnson.
Aye.
Lee Johnson, aye. Rep. Edelson.
Aye.
Rep. Edelson, aye. Rep. Feist?
Aye.
Rep. Feist, aye. Rep. Grossel?
Aye.
Rep. Grossel, aye. Rep. Hollins?
Aye.
Rep. Hollins, aye. Rep. Hewitt?
Aye.
Rep. Hewitt, aye. Rep. Cleavorne?
Cleavorne, aye.
Rep. Cleavorne, aye. Rep. Long?
Aye.
Rep. Long, aye. Rep. Lucero? Rep. Lucero? Rep. Mueller?
Mueller votes yes.
Mueller, aye. Rep. Novotny?
Novotny, aye.
Rep. Novotny, aye. Rep. O'Neill?
O'Neill, aye.
Rep. O'Neill, aye. Rep. Pinto?
Aye.
Rep. Pinto, aye. Rep. Poston?
Aye.
Rep. Poston, aye. Rep. Raleigh?
Raleigh, aye.
Rep. Raleigh, aye. Rep. Vang?
Aye.
Rep. Vang, aye. Rep. Shung?
Shung, aye.
Rep. Shung, aye. Last call for Rep. Lucero?
I just got back, so I just don't know where you're to vote, so I'm going to pass. Haven't heard the bill.
Rep. Lucero, abstain. With 18 ayes, 0 nays, and 1 abstain, that concludes roll call.
Very well. With 18 ayes, 0 nays, and 1 abstention, the motion prevails, and House File 3869 is referred to the General Register. Thank you, members. The final bill is House File 1369. This is also the chair's bill. The chair will move House File 1369.
Chair Mariani?
Representative Johnson.
I just have a quick question on this bill. On March
29th. I'm sorry, on House File, on the current one?
No, 1369, the one you're about to bring up.
Okay.
on March 22nd, 2001, the committee adopted this and sent this bill to Ways and Means. It's sitting in the committee in Ways and Means. I'm just wondering how you plan to bring up and do your DE amendment when we do not have possession of this bill.
Let me just check on that right now. I don't believe that's the case, but let me check. Lee Johnson, while we're checking it, I still don't have an answer. Why don't we do this? Because I want to make sure we get this right. Let me take the testimony on this. I do have a couple of folks who have signed up to testify, including one that I've arranged for, and so I want to make sure I use their time appropriately, and that'll give me a little bit more time to find out the technical status of House File 1369. So for the moment, let's do an informational hearing on House File 1369. It is my intent to have a DE4, a DE amendment to that entitled DE4, and so the testimony will be to the language in the DE4 amendment. And then let me just make a few, very quick opening comments. This bill establishes a task force on collecting charging and related data. This year, as you all know, members, there's been a lot of interest in criminal charging decisions made by our prosecutors. And frankly, it's the interest comes from all sorts of stakeholders. There are those who are interested in understanding, whether there's quote unquote undercharging happening. By the same token, there are others that are interested in knowing whether there's quote unquote overcharging happening in the home. What we do know is that there certainly are disparities that exist that are both racial disparities, but also geographic disparities in regards to charging. But even there, we don't have a full picture. And quite frankly, those disparities shouldn't come as any surprise, given that disparities have long been a feature of our criminal justice system. Which is why this legislature has wisely in the past worked to address those in different ways, like the action 40 years ago that created the Minnesota Sentencing Guideline. However, here's the challenge, members. There's no statewide repository system of data that we can intelligently look at and study and reflect to determine if charging decisions are impacting both public safety and or inequities in our criminal justice system. So this bill quite simply creates a way to design such a system by creating a task force of vital stakeholders that would include prosecutors, defense attorneys, judges, law enforcement voices, citizens, including survivor victims, and those involved in our probation systems. There's a laid out design in terms of some of those being appointed by the governor, others being appointed by respective institutions like the Attorney General, the Supreme Court, as well as the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. I basically use the design that we use with the current Minnesota Sentencing Guideline System, but really turning it to make sure that there's a strong focus of our prosecutors in that task force. The task force then would develop recommendations around data and data collection to help us answer some of the concerns and questions that have been raised of late, and to develop actions for a long-term sustainable data collection system, as well as to consider future policy recommendations that it can make to the legislature and report back to us by the year 2024. To speak to this issue, I have Ms. Kelly Mitchell, who's the director of the Robina Institute. And so at this point, I'd like to call Ms. Mitchell forward to provide us her testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Kelly Mitchell. I'm the executive director of the Robina Institute of Criminal Law and Criminal Justice at the University of Minnesota Law School. And I'm here today to offer support in establishing a task force on charging and related data. And you know me, I never come to this committee without pictures. So I'm going to share my screen and give you a couple of pictures to go with this topic. The first thing I'd like to say is I'd like to point out that prosecutors nationally are already beginning to make charging data available. They want to see it themselves to understand trends and make policy choices. And they're also being responsive to a greater call for transparency in prosecutorial decision making. Here in Minnesota, Hennepin County has already created and posted this dashboard on their website. And you can see pretty quickly that they already provide a lot of information about charging decisions. You can see how many cases have been referred to them by law enforcement, what kinds of offenses are included in those, what their charging decisions were. Did they charge that case, decline it, divert it? What were the race and genders of the individuals who were involved in these cases? And what sorts of dispositions did they receive? It would be amazing if we had this level of information across the state, but that may not be realistic given the varying resources within each county. So a major goal of the task force is to determine what's feasible, what information would be most important for us to know, and what we can realistically begin to collect on a statewide basis. To give you a deeper sense of what we might be able to understand by collecting charging data, I'm going to show you some data collected for the Truth in Action Project at Mitchell-Hamlin, which is a project that's aimed at expanding understanding of racial disparity in the criminal justice system and developing an action plan for systemic change. Robina is currently serving as the research partner for that project at Mitchell-Hamlin. So we've been collecting data at various decision points across the criminal justice system, and one of those data points is the charging decision. So this first slide shows, and Hennepin and Ramsey County have been actually very forthcoming with their data to allow us to take a deeper dive here. And this first slide shows the number of cases referred to them by law enforcement. So you can see a couple of things right away. Hennepin County has a much larger caseload than Ramsey County, about double the caseload. And that over these 3 years, the number of cases referred to them from law enforcement did go up. So that's a trend that we can see. Now let's look at those same cases by race. And so this shows the racial breakdown of the cases that were referred for prosecution. This is before the prosecutor has made any decision. And the last two bars on this slide show what the 2020 population is for each of those counties as well. So what really jumps out is in both counties, nearly half or more than half of the cases referred for prosecution involve people identified as Black, even though within the counties, that group only represents 13 to 14% of the population. Conversely, the proportion of people referred for prosecution who were white is about a third of the cases, even though they're about two-thirds of the population in both counties. The next slide shows that in both Hennepin and Ramsey, prosecutors consistently charged about two-thirds of the cases that were referred to them each year, and about one-third to a quarter were declined for prosecution in each year. But we don't know what the reasons were. We didn't have information on the reasons for declination. Now, finally, this table combines the data for the three-year period and compares the racial composition of cases referred for prosecution to the racial composition of cases charged. In Ramsey County, those proportions remain the same. In Hennepin County, the proportions are really similar, but the people who were Black increased slightly in the charged population, and those who were white decreased slightly. So what we see from this is that the racial disparities in charging decisions actually reflect the disparities at arrest and referral for prosecution. So, and this is really important to know. we have a lot of data in Minnesota, right? And we've been concerned about this for some time. I've been before this committee testifying about racial disparities in sentencing in the past. But what this is telling us is that there's already a huge imbalance at the front end of the system with the cases that are coming in. So if we want to tackle racial disparity, we need to be tackling the front end of the system. Up until now, though, this piece about charging was missing from our analysis. We didn't know how the charging decision may or may not have affected racial disparity. So I offer this as an example. Here we were trying to understand racial disparity, but as you can imagine, there's multiple questions that could be answered if we had data at the prosecutorial stage. As you saw with the dashboard in Hennepin, we could be looking more closely at offense types, at diversions, at outcomes such as dismissals and convictions. But first, we need to figure out what data is available and what key decision points we want to understand. The task force would be important to gathering that input and being smart about designing a framework that's going to give us meaningful information. For example, the task force may identify that we want to know declination reasons, but if only half the state is collecting that data, then the task force is going to have to be really reasoned and have a very strong reason for recommending that be collected statewide. So we want to make sure that the data that we're asking for is available, that it's truly going to be meaningful, and that if we're asking people to collect something new, that we're going to need it to understand the system. So with that, I express my support for the establishment of this task force, and I'll stand for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Mitchell. Appreciate your testimony and the data. First of all, let me turn back to Lee Johnson. So Lee Johnson, turns out you're absolutely correct. And so thank you for catching, good catch. Thank you for, quite frankly, helping me from making a mistake, although our intent here was to lay this over. But you're right, we do not have jurisdiction of this. So I appreciate you pointing that out to me. Obviously still important that we hear the information, and my intent would be to make sure that bill gets properly back to us, and so that we can move to include it in our omnibus bill. We do have a couple of testifiers. I want to make sure I get to them as quickly as possible to honor them. We have Mark Metz of the Carver County attorney, as well as Bob Small from the Municipal County Attorneys Association. So let me call on you first, County Attorney Metz. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Yeah, good morning, Mr. Chair and representatives. My name is Mark Metz. I'm the Carver County Attorney and the president of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. Keep my comments very brief, and I'm certainly open for questions, but if there's going to be a collection of charging and related data, the Minnesota County Attorneys Association supports the creation of the task force that will assure that the data is collected and it's relevant, complete, and accurate. So those are my comments, but as I indicated, I'm happy to answer any other questions, but we would support that. And thank you for allowing us to give input at the County Attorneys Association to work with you on this bill. Thank you.
I appreciate that, Mr. Metz. And yes, I think, you know, it's been really good to be able to connect with each other early, you know, to continue to have this conversation, shape this bill. Appreciate the County Attorney Association willingness to do that. Mr. Small of the County Attorney Association, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Robert Small. I'm the Executive Director of the County Attorneys Association. As it relates to this bill and the report that you will eventually receive as a result of this report, it would be most helpful for each of you, except perhaps for Representative Pinto, who does this every day, but it would be nice and helpful for your better understanding of what prosecutors do to visit your county attorney, perhaps even during the next break, and see what it is that prosecutors do and how they go about making those important decisions. Experience firsthand for yourself how county attorneys make those important charging decisions. you can observe for yourselves and you can ask questions on how they carry out their responsibilities of being ministers of justice. You can see how they review all available facts. They review all available evidence. They review the applicable law, and they decide, one, not only whether or not there's probable cause to believe that a crime has been committed and someone has committed it, but also whether there is a reasonable belief that each element of that crime can be proved beyond a reasonable doubt. And lastly, that the decision to charge is in the interest of justice. That's what prosecutors do every day. And we would invite you to go to your county attorney and sit with your county attorney and go through that experience. And then I would urge, after you've gone through that experience, share that experience with each other. Have conversations about what you have just reserved and see if, based on your experience and your discussions, whether or not the process is done consistently in all 87 counties. And you can also decide whether or not charging decisions are made solely based on the appropriate standards. Our county attorneys think that by personally visiting those offices, having the chance to observe the making of those charging decisions, to ask questions about those decisions, and asking those who have the responsibility to do this every day, you will be better informed about not only this bill, but also about any recommendations this task force might have for you. And Mr. Chair, thank you very much for allowing me to make those comments, and Mr. Metz and I will stand for any questions.
Very well, Judge Spall. Excellent advice. I do appreciate that. As someone who has a relationship with his county attorney, I absolutely would echo, you know, that encouragement, frankly, duty for all of us to pursue. And I, let me just move quickly to committee members, excuse me, Vice Chair Frazier and then Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Judge Small. Yeah, I agree with what your chair said. That's a great idea to connect with your county attorneys to see how they do the work. This question is for Kelly Mitchell. Kelly or Ms. Mitchell, my understanding is that in the previous draft of this bill, the ability of the Sentencing Commission to collect charging data was in there, and then it was removed. Is that correct,
Ms. Mitchell?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Frazier. I believe that is correct.
All right. But now I've learned that the Sentencing Guideline Commission already has the authority to collect this data from the courts. Is that correct?
Ms. Mitchell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Frazier, I would probably defer to Director Wrights to give the exact answer on that, but I do believe that the statute that creates the Sentencing Guidelines Commission sets up the commission as a clearinghouse for information on criminal justice. And in that regard, it is partly our role to collect information that would be relevant to advise the legislature on topics, on criminal justice topics.
I'm not sure if Director Wrights is still with us. Oh, yes. If you can jump in, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question, Vice Chair Frazier. I would agree that it is within the scope of the commission's role as a clearinghouse and information center. Its primary focus is on sentencing data, but it also has additional research capabilities given to it in statute. I think Chair Mariani articulated some of the problems with this particular type of data. It's just very hard to access. It's that there are a lot of problems getting to it. There are also problems, frankly, with the size of the agency. As we've already learned, it's a pretty small agency, and I think to delve into a new area like this would require some additional funding. So, frankly, Vice Chair Frazier, I would see this as sort of being a first step to getting the lay of the land, figuring out where the data is, figuring out how the data can be accessed. And And then perhaps phase two, and I don't want to get ahead of what might happen as a result of this task force, but maybe this could be something that the Sentencing Guidelines Commission could do within its existing statutory mandate is track this data. But right now it's scattered in 87 places, if you will, and I think it would be hard to get at right now.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you for that. I think I get the gist of it, that it looks like likely, yes, with the broad purview, you'd be able to collect this data, but how effective and efficient we could be right now is the issue. Thank you both.
Thank you for the questions, and thank you, Director Wrights. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, Judge Small, thank you. Thank you for that charge to us that, you know, you and I've worked on legislation for a very long time, and thank you for saying that. I love to go to tours and visits, and we have a brand new county attorney out here in Wright County. He took over from a very, very long time, Tom Kelly. And so I have had quite a bit of time visiting him. I see him quite often in the community as well, not just in his office, but we cross paths all the time. And I can't tell you how valuable his relationship is to inform my decisions here at the legislature. He is absolutely valuable. And Brian Lutz, if you're listening, fantastic job. You're doing a great job. And I know he's, sometimes he actually listens to this as well. So thank you for that. I would ask every member of this committee to go and talk to their county attorney and have that really intense relationship, because that's really how we're informed and how we do our job. To the merits of the bill, Mr. Chair, I would ask this, that if we're going to be doing a task force, I would ask the legislature would be appointing the different members of the task force, and that legislators would be members of the task force. And the reason I'm saying that, Mr. Chair, I have been a part of many advisory councils, task force, working groups, whatever you want to call them. I've been on them all, some very successful ones, some frustrating ones. And what I find incredibly helpful is if you have members of the legislature, not necessarily guiding the discussion, that's not important, but what is important is listening and being informed. And you know, Mr. Chair, I have been a part of many. Most recent, I've been on the Predatory Offender Reform Working Group. Wow, that's a lot. There's a lot. And we had three subgroups and one large group meeting. And I went to every single meeting so that I was fully informed as to the conversations. So, Mr. Chair, I would ask two things. Again, if we're going to do this, that the legislature would be doing the appointing and not the governor, or, you know, each individual, you know, obviously county attorneys can put representatives of county attorney and so on. But, and also please appoint people from the legislature, because I can't tell you how incredibly valuable it is to have one, two, or four, however many legislators a part of the process. Then we can be fully informed. And sometimes they ask me my opinion. It's not always that important, but it is important for me to hear, listen, and learn. And so, Mr. Chair, that is my deepest, sincere request to you as you're moving through and working on this bill. And the last thing I would say, Mr. Chair, is specifically, so I'm looking at your DE4, and in Subdivision 6, which is starting on line 3.19, it says that this report would go back to the Public Safety Committee. And I would ask, because this has so much to do with judiciary, that not just the chairs and ranking members of public safety would get this report, but also judiciary. I think it's really important. If we're going to collect this information and look at it in that way, that would be included as well. I guess I'm going to say one other quick thing. So up on line 3.9, you are creating a central location for all this information. And so all of that needs to have proper data audits and all that kind of stuff. So when you're creating a central location for all this information, this really has to go to judiciary, because all of that data needs to have audit trails and all that, because we're talking about very sensitive information, non-public information. So that needs to be incorporated here too. And again, that's in the realm of judiciary. This definitely needs to go there as well. But those are some of my key concerns. And I'm not necessarily opposed to having a task force, but it really should be framed in the manner that I've already described. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very well, thank you, Representative O'Neill. Again, in the spirit of co-designing and problem solving, I welcome your comments. Certainly have an open mind on both those points. I do think that the Judiciary Committee makes absolute sense for a number of reasons, and you cited two of those. So that's awfully good, and I will certainly keep open the legislative role on the task force itself. I concur with your observation that being informed and informing from that perspective is certainly important. You know, going forward, you know, if there is obviously I won't be here, and obviously, you know, the task force will have the autonomy to make its recommendations. I would counsel the group to, similar to the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, to maintain some element of autonomy to make sure that whatever permanent reflection and recommendations they're making are not, skewed, if you will, from, legislative perspectives, which unfortunately, and I certainly have engaged in these, unfortunately at times have become a little bit too partisan. So part of the point is we really want objective analysis. But I do think that at the very least that early legislative, participation seems to make a lot of sense. I really appreciate your thoughtfulness on that. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. I had put my hand down, but I appreciate that. So something else that's really important to understand is if the governor wants to have a task force, he has the full ability, power to create his own. But we are the legislature. We're an entire different branch of government. So if we're going to create a task force, then we need to inform and create that. And so my concern is the governor is creating this task force. He is appointing most of the members. And there is no legislative members a part of it. So I appreciate the fact that you want less partisanship, but let me implore you that we, the legislature, if we're going to create a task force, then we should create the task force. The governor can do his own. And, you know, I've been asked to be a part of governor task forces and advisor councils and all of that and the like as well. He has the full autonomy to do that, but we are the legislature. So I would just ask that if we're going to bring something to the legislature, that we would form that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Really good point. I really do appreciate that, Representative O'Neill. All right, members, we are at the end here. Again, thank you, Lee Johnson. We were going to lay this over anyway, but certainly did not want to create a confusing process to formally have a bill before us that we don't have possession of. We will certainly... it's the chair's intent to certainly come back to this issue at a later date. I do appreciate everyone's engagement and openness that they approach this and all the other bills here today. Seeing no other business before us, we'll plan to get back together at our normal time next Tuesday. No evening meeting next Tuesday. So, all right, members, until then, this committee stands adjourned.